Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On March 2, 2021, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Brnovich versus the Democratic National Convention. The issues before the court was first, whether Arizona's out-of-precinct policy, which does not count provisional ballots cast in person on Election Day outside of the voter's designated precinct, violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and second, whether Arizona's ballot collection law, which permits only certain persons, for instance, family and household members, caregivers, mail carriers, and election officials, to handle other persons' completed early ballot, violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act or the 15th Amendment. Derek Muller, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law, joins us today to discuss this case's oral argument.
The Supreme Court heard its argument in Brnovich versus DNC, and this is a case that's been bubbling up in the lower courts and didn't really have an effect on this presidential election, but understandably, all election laws have been drawing significant renewed attention, and every 4 years, it seems like we see more and more litigation over them. So Arizona had a couple of statutes on its books that were challenged by the Democratic National Committee. One was a longstanding statute prohibiting out-of-precinct ballots from being counted. If you cast your ballot in the wrong precinct, they would allow you to cast a provisional ballot. They take a look at it and determine whether or not you were actually erroneously excluded from that precinct. But if you're in the wrong precinct, they don't count the ballot. And the DNC said, well, this is a this violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It disproportionately and adversely affects minority voters who are more likely to cast their ballots outside of the precinct. You should at the very least count, things like statewide offices on that ballot, even if they're in the wrong precinct, if they're otherwise eligible voters. Additionally, there was a new statute passed a few years ago in Arizona to ban ballot harvesting or third-party collection of ballots. That is the opportunity for other individuals apart from you or your immediate family, county workers or postal workers, from collecting your ballot. And, concerns about voter intimidation, ballot fraud, all those kinds of things. So this was enacted in Arizona, and there was a challenge to that statute too, saying, listen, we can identify some of the racially tinged statements of a member of the legislature. We have a video showing some racially tinged commentary about the defense of this ballot harvesting ban. Additionally, we know that Native Americans and Hispanic voters are more likely to rely on third parties to carry their ballots on their behalf. The mail is much more difficult to obtain in portions of tribal reservations in Arizona. So this also provides a discriminatory burden. And the state of Arizona was defending both of these statutes, and again, under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And, one of the great challenges over the last decade, I would say, is that the courts, the lower courts, have been struggling to think about how to apply this provision of the Voting Rights Act when it comes to vote denial claims. That is, for a long time, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, starting with amendments enacted in the 1980s, has been used principally as a basis to ensure that minority voters have the opportunity to elect the preferred candidate of their choice. What that usually translates into is, in redistricting, ensuring that there are districts in which there are a sufficient number of minority voters who are able to elect the candidate of their choice, and vote dilution claims, if you will. If there is a district with a couple of districts that have black voters spread out among them, where their preferences are overwhelmed informed by white voters' choices. Oftentimes, a court will look and determine whether or not to draw a district to provide those black voters with a district to elect the preferred candidate of their choice. But unfortunately, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is not the clearest in language. It provides that if under the totality of the circumstances, the political processes leading up to the election in the state are not equally open to the participation by members of a class of citizens protected by subsection A, that is about providing the right to vote regardless of race or color, and that its members have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect the representatives of their choice. So Arizona's defense of these statutes is to say these are, if you will, equal opportunity statutes. They treat all voters the same. Everyone has the opportunity, and it's actually an error to look at each one of these provisions separately. You should be looking at the total suite of voting opportunities available to voters. You should be looking at the fact that it's not just whether or not you can have a third party collect your ballot or voting out of precincts. You should look at all of the many other voting opportunities, in-person voting, early voting, absentee voting, all the variety and suite of opportunities available to you. And because of that, these opportunities are available to everyone, and we shouldn't really focus on, you know, the fact that it might inconvenience some subgroup of voters, particularly given that, you know, when it comes to out-of-precinct voting, it was less than 1%, if not less than 1,500ths of a percent of voters who had difficulty with the out-of-precinct voting policy. So this, in contrast, the Democratic National Committee was focused principally looking at the results, and that is, if you can show some statistical disparity between populations of voters, and we are unable to sort of come forward, and we can establish that those disparities exist and interact with some historic socioeconomic conditions, along with the history of perhaps racial discrimination in the state, among other factors, then we can sort of say that these kinds of procedures are improper. They result in certain protected classes of individuals from being able to equally participate in the political process. And I would say that as the argument went on today, you know, there was a lot of discussion about should the focus really be on the opportunity and what that means? Should the focus really be on the results and what that means, and how do we assess it? But at the district court level, the district court, after a 10-day trial, concluded that despite the fact that there were some of these instances of racial overtones from at least one legislator and perhaps elsewhere in the record, that there was no finding of intentional discrimination, and finding that neither of these policies violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Went as appeal to the Eighth Circuit, and a panel of the Eighth Circuit agreed, but then it went before an en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit, which reversed and found intentional discrimination on the part of the Arizona legislature, in addition to finding that both of these policies improperly abridged the right of minority voters to participate in the political process. The opinion sort of sweeps back to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and traces forward for over 150 years of Arizona history to explain why this policy was discriminatory and disproportionately affected minority voters. So before the Supreme Court, you know, there is a sense in which there's this finding of intentional racial discrimination on the part of the Arizona legislature that got some attention from members of the court. And in particular, how are we supposed to assess, you know, if we have on the record one member of the legislature, how do we assess, you know, his statements? How do we attribute them to the remainder of the legislature? And Chief Justice Roberts, in particular, was concerned about this kind of assessment. The Ninth Circuit had something of, if you will, a cat's paw theory, where in the old story where the monkey instructs the cat to get the chestnuts out of the fire, and it's the cat that actually burns his hand, but the monkey is really the one responsible, right? The argument being, if there's one legislator that is essentially providing these racially tinged statements, those can be attributed to the entirety of the legislature. Chief Justice Roberts was pretty strongly inclined against that kind of imputation of intent to the entirety of the legislature. But there was a number of sort of back and forth among some of the justices about evaluating the Arlington Heights factors, about evaluating whether or not it's a factor and how significant it is among sort of the remainder of the decision-making process that occurred. So there was that intentional discrimination claim. But then, you know, again, the heart of the matter was really looking at sort of how to examine a Section 2 claim under the Voting Rights Act and how to make this assessment, given that the language is not the most clear. And I think it was Justice Kavanaugh who late in the argument sort of was really emphasizing that it didn't feel like the party, at least at argument, were really sticking to a pure equal opportunity side of things versus a pure results side of thing. There was some suggestion about some sort of intermediate position and figuring out what that looks like. That is, if you can show some sort of result of a substantial or significant, and you know, adjectives and adverbs like this were thrown about at the argument today, some sort of substantial discriminatory impact on racial minorities. And then the question is, what do you do with that? If it looks like that there's something in the effects and the outcome. The statute doesn't speak in terms of intent. It just talks about equal opportunity. Does the state need to come forward with some evidence then to explain why it has done so? And if so, what are some of those, again, in other words of the statute, the totality of the circumstances that would allow a state to sort of defend the practice or policy? Is it concerns about fraud? Is it just sound election administration? A couple of notions that Justice Kavanaugh gravitated toward were saying, you know, if this is sort of a policy recommended by a bipartisan commission, for instance, the Jimmy Carter and James Baker had a bipartisan commission 15 years ago advocating for ending ballot harvesting in the United States, allowing immediate family members and household members and postal workers to carry your ballot, but not allowing third parties who could otherwise intimidate you. So that, in his view, would be a good circumstance that would justify Arizona's policy. Or if there are commonplace practices in other states, like out-of-precinct voting prohibitions. The Democratic National Committee pushed back to say, look, in Arizona doesn't not every county uses a precinct-based system. Some have vote centers, and the Carter-Baker Commission was not something the Arizona legislature relied upon, so we shouldn't be using those kinds of factors. But I think there's no question that there were concerns among the justices as they were offering hypotheticals about how are we supposed to assess, say, a poll closing at 7 p.m. And the effect that it has on voters. Real worries about thinking about how some of these rules would essentially invite litigation almost anywhere in the country to the extent that they could be shown to have any kind of disparate impact on some set of voters. There were a number of hypotheticals that were raised at various points throughout the argument that I think really tested the parties in some respects. One is Justice Kagan offered some hypotheticals about suppose there's a country club puts all of its polling, or that all the polling places are put at country clubs in the state. And we know that black voters have to drive 10 times as far to places that are traditionally hostile toward black voters. For the Republican Party, there was a suggestion, yeah, it was, in fact, that might actually be less of an opportunity, even though it's a facially neutral rule. And Justice Barrett later in the argument said, well, it seems like you're putting a lot of work on opportunity here then, right? Because it does seem like we're talking about outcomes in these cases, right? It seems like if you're saying that there's some notable difference and we're supposed to take demographic differences into account, it does seem like opportunity is doing a little bit more work here than you sort of let on by just saying there's some equality in treatment at the front end. On the other side, when challenging the Democratic position, Justice Alito offered some hypotheticals to try to figure out what this would look like, applying it to some rules. When it came to something like, you know, suppose that there's a challenge to a voting policy where there's 2 weeks of early voting and someone wants it to become 60 days of early voting, and we have some evidence of disparate effect on minority voters, or about suppose ballots are supposed to be received within 3 days after the election, but someone is able to challenge to say they should really come in 1 week after the election. And the responses were again not very persuasive in saying, well, I mean, statistical disparities alone are not enough. We have to look at socioeconomic factors. And again, I don't think that gave much comfort to Justice Alito. If that's what the evidence shows, then it would suggest that there's essentially plaintiffs would always be able to find a population that could be adversely affected by an existing law and then bring in a challenge to potentially sweep in every kind of election law. So late in the argument, Justice Kagan suggested it was not clear how much daylight there was between the two parties, but undoubtedly there was some question about first, you know, what is that sort of position in between equal opportunity at the front end, facially neutral laws that appear equally open to everyone, versus the back end of a pure results test. Any statute that has any disparate impact on some subpopulation on the basis of race or color. And given that, there was, I think, you know, some effort on the court to figure out what kind of evidence would the state have to put forward that would therefore justify its position, or how often should it have to be dragged into court to demonstrate that. A couple of last points. One is, you know, Justice Barrett and others had mentioned about this concern thinking about what's an inconvenience in voting versus a burden in voting. And this came out also early in the argument from Michael Carvin and others to suggest that we need to think about the ordinary burdens of voting, as you might say, in a case like Crawford versus Marion County, the voter identification case, where that is, there are just the things you have to affirmatively do. You have to go register, or you have to go request a ballot, or you have to fill out the ballot, or you have to do things. And so there is a notion that there's some ordinariness to these election laws and figuring out where that sort of threshold, you know, resides. And I think it was Justice Breyer who laid in the argument sort of really emphasized that he was concerned about some kind of test where we're worried about sort of just chance disparities between racial populations. And so he really wanted to emphasize language like a significant difference in minority populations and their ability to participate in the political process. So I think, you know, overall, I think the parties were struggling figuring out how to identify the outer bounds of some of the arguments that the courts were raising. On the one hand, Democratic National Committee, as the respondents here, they didn't want to suggest that every election law was going to be subject to litigation and potentially ripe for review if you're able to demonstrate some socioeconomic disparities. At the same time, I'm not sure that they appeased the fears of many on the court about that finding. On the flip side, I think the petitioners and state of Arizona, you know, wanted to recognize that there are kinds of rules that can adversely and significantly adversely affect certain minority populations in voting without conceding that sort of everything should be called into question, and figuring out at what point have we said there's a lack of opportunity up at the outset. So I think this is the challenge, you know, thinking about that sort of middle line and how to put a cognizable test from the Supreme Court to the lower courts that is going to be administrable, that's going to adhere even loosely to, you know, the opportunity language within the Voting Rights Act, while at the same time not calling into question the vast majority of election laws in the United States, especially those, you know, like out of precinct policy in Arizona that have been around for quite some time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.